Coming up on Fronteras, a former technology editor is teaming up with a 26-year-old engineering whiz from Tijuana to bring military drone technology to the masses.
You'll think of them as being like crop dusters. You will think of them with entirely new context. We'll forget that drones were once a defense industry thing, and we'll think of it as something you buy at Walmart.
The developing do-it-yourself drone industry. And a new documentary follows journalists in Mexico who risk their lives to report on that country's drug war.
Time and time again, the journalists have set the desire to publish information that's going to put them in harm's way, because they feel like despite burying their colleagues and despite the violence that's consumed their country, they still feel like they still have a sense of optimism.
We talked to filmmaker Bernardo Ruiz about his first documentary feature, Reportero, premiering soon on PBS. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among 7 public radio stations and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local journalism center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. When you hear the word drone, images of warfare or high-tech surveillance come to mind. But 2 entrepreneurs have a different idea. They believe drones will literally revolutionize our daily lives. Editor-in-chief of Wired magazine Chris Anderson recently resigned. He's now teaming up with a 26-year-old engineering whiz from Tijuana to jumpstart what they call the personal drone industry. John Rossman has the story.
Outside a warehouse in San Diego, engineers huddle over a computer. They're about to launch a drone or a remote-controlled aerial vehicle. They punch in a start and endpoint on a map and take off. The quadcopter that zips by looks like a toddler's nightstand. It doesn't look that threatening, and that's what Chris Anderson's betting on. He says in a decade, drones will have evolved way beyond their current military uses.
You'll think of them as being like crop dusters. You will think of them with entirely new context. We'll forget that drones were once a defense industry thing, and we'll think of it as something you buy at Walmart.
What makes a drone is the ability to go from point A to point B with a click of a mouse or a touch of a screen without direct human interaction. It's a robot using GPS to perform a simple command. Go here. But it's also a launch pad for amazing possibilities.
Well, what if we sold a box that you could put on your belt, and while you're out windsurfing, drones would just follow you 30 feet up, 30 feet back, keep the camera on you as you did your cool stuff.
Imagine how this could impact search and rescue missions or pizza delivery. These flying nightstands could transform into hoverboards a la Back to the Future or a fleet of mail carriers.
Yeah, here goes.
This is Anderson and his kids flying a remote-controlled plane. It's 2007 and he's obsessed with the possibility of drones. So much so, he started a blog, DIY, Do-It-Yourself Drones, to learn about the emerging landscape. A few hundred miles south, Jordi Munoz was ripping apart a toy helicopter and a Nintendo Wii. The 21-year-old programmer was scouring Google to find out how to use the sensors from the Wii to get his helicopter to fly straight.
1 week before I Googled something, I didn't find anything. And a week later, I Googled the same thing. And I found this blog.
Munoz joined the DIY Drones blog and started sharing the code from his project.
I was just in my own world in a bubble. So I was like super obsessed doing, trying to make it work, finally work. And then I posted online. And probably I didn't realize that probably I was doing something high-end.
Anderson was blown away by that code. The two immediately hit it off and began collaborating. Fast forward 5 years, today they're running a multi-million dollar cross-border company that produces and sells hardware and personal drones. The company, 3D Robotics, found success in Munoz's misunderstood hometown, Tijuana. Here's Chris Anderson.
Prior to 18 months ago, I thought Tijuana was drug cartels and cheap tequila. What Jordi knew and taught me was that Tijuana is the Shenzhen of North America.
Shenzhen is China's manufacturing epicenter just north of Hong Kong.
It's not just cheap, it's better skilled. They graduate more engineers. So those manufacturing skills that we've lost in much of the United States are still there.
Anderson believes their use of Tijuana's high-skilled, low-cost labor, teamed with San Diego's engineers, is the business model of the future. The goal now is to streamline the whole process for the consumer. Buy the drone, download the app, type in the coordinates, and go. Simple enough for a grandmother to fly, and open source for programmers to reinvent the product. But drones remain suspect. Many are concerned about a more invasive drone future, with devices like flying sniper rifles or hovering spy cameras. Ask Chris Anderson, and he will tell you it's entirely possible.
General-purpose technologies are incredibly empowering. They change the world. But by definition, they don't limit the way you use it. Somebody's going to do something stupid. We can't stop them.
Remember, computer technology got its biggest early boost from the military. Chris Anderson is literally banking on the inevitability that the good this technology could do, be it food drops in Africa or firefighting down the street, will ultimately outweigh the destruction it could cause. In San Diego, I'm John Rossman.
48 journalists were murdered or disappeared since December 2006. That's according to a new documentary, Reportero, premiering Monday on KLRN at 9 p.m. as a special broadcast of Point of View. Reportero is director Bernardo Ruiz's first documentary feature. It looks at how journalists at a Tijuana-based news weekly risked their lives to report on Mexico's drug war. Ruiz began the conversation telling me how the decision to do this film came about.
The film actually started when I was looking for another story. So back in 2007, I was actually researching a story about a shelter for deported migrants in the city of Mexicali, which is the capital of Baja Norte, right there on the California-Mexico border. You know, initially I thought I would just make a kind of quiet film about this shelter that was receiving Mexican and Central American migrant youth after they'd been deported at different parts of the California-Mexico border. But when I started doing my research, you know, it coincided with a time with a rise in narco violence that we know today. And everybody who I talked to had stories about a relative who had been threatened with kidnapping or extortion, in some cases relatives who'd been murdered. And I felt like it was important to address this other story that was happening. And so I asked around and asked it to be put in touch with a journalist because I wanted to get a better sense of, get some perspective on what was happening there. And eventually I got in touch with Sergio Aro, who ends up being the protagonist in the film, the main character of Reportero. I, you know, was just planning to have a short meeting with Sergio just to discuss the region and get some background. And I always tell people that it was like a good first date. we're supposed to have a 30-minute meeting, and it turned into a 3-hour conversation. And by the end of that conversation, I felt like his story and the story of the paper that he works for, SETA, I felt like their story was much more urgent than anything I'd originally been thinking of.
Tell me a little bit about their operations and where they're based out of and whatnot.
So SETA is a kind of legendary newspaper. It's a weekly that's based out of Tijuana, and they publish every Friday morning. The paper is distributed throughout Baja California, but it's also a kind of important source of news for the California-Mexico border on the Mexican side. It's the go-to place for a lot of international journalists and a lot of people who are reporting from Mexico City. And SETA has really developed a reputation for being really aggressive in its coverage of organized crime, and not only organized crime, but the kind of links between organized crime and political corruption. Pretty much since its inception in 1980, the paper has been really hitting the crime story and the politics stories very hard, oftentimes with some really serious consequences. At least 3 of the staffers have been killed. And the founder of the newspaper, an editor named Jesus Blancornelas, was very famously ambushed in a daylight attack in 1997. He was set upon by 10 gunmen, miraculously survived that attack. But they've had a very storied and very, very difficult history. And to be honest, I was surprised that nobody had made a film about their story. It's such a dramatic story, and I believe such an important story. I was really surprised that nobody had kind of tackled their story before.
And these reporters that you say were killed, were they killed by people they reported on, by drug cartels?
So in the case of SETA, the murders of the journalists coincide with the history of the paper. So in 1988, SETA's co-editor, Hector Felix Miranda, was murdered on a Tijuana street. He was shot while he was idling in his car. And there, two men were charged in the killing, and they were the one was the bodyguard of a local businessman, Jorge Henkron, who would later go on to become the mayor of Tijuana. And it was widely believed that Hector Felix Miranda was murdered for printing a very unfavorable story of Jorge Henkron. Now, Jorge Henkron was never charged in the murder, although people in his employ were charged, were arrested and are serving time for murdering Hector Felix Miranda. Then in 1997, Jesus Blanco Ornelas, as I said, was set upon by 10 gunmen. In that case, although Blanco Ornelas miraculously survived, his driver and SETA staffer, Luis Valero, was killed.
How did he survive if he was ambushed?
It's actually one of the more extraordinary stories that you see in the film. Blanco Ornelas was just a few blocks from the editorial offices of SETA, and 10 hitmen, allegedly hired by the Arellano-Felix cartel, were basically sending a volley of fire at the vehicle. And in the ambush, the lead hitman, who was a hired killer named David Barone Corona, who's from San Diego, a piece of shrapnel from his one of his bullets ricocheted off of the vehicle and bounced back into his eye, killing him instantly.
Wow.
And David Barone Corona dropped dead, bleeding to death there. And the other hitmen saw what had happened and fled. And it was really that fluke accident that saved Blanco Ornelas' life. Unfortunately, Luis Valero, Blanco Ornelas' driver, died in the attack. In 2004, another SETA editor, Francisco Ortiz Franco, published a piece where he ran the photographs, basically the names and faces of low-level cartel operatives. These are people who are used to operating with impunity and anonymity, and they didn't like having their identities made public. Organized crime figures who definitely did not want their names and faces made public. And in June of 2004, while he was also waiting in his car with his two children, he was shot in the back of the head and killed in front of his children. So in all cases, there were very strong reasons to believe that these journalists were murdered, or these SETA staffers were murdered for what they had published. They were either attacked or murdered for what they had published in the pages of SETA.
And not everyone was thoroughly investigated in these cases.
That's a polite way of saying it. In all of these cases, they were not the perpetrators of the crime. The alleged perpetrators were never investigated thoroughly. And to this day, that's unfortunately it's a trend that continues. And the vast majority of cases in crimes against journalists in Mexico, there's no effective prosecution of the folks who are involved. You know, it's not happening for ordinary citizens in Mexico, and it's definitely not happening for journalists.
Our conversation with Bernardo Ruiz, the writer, director, and producer of the film Reportero, continues here on Fronteras after a short break. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Welcome back. Mexican journalists risk their lives to report the truth about Mexico's drug war, and some of them pay the ultimate price. The documentary Reportero premieres Monday on KLRN at 9 p.m. as a special broadcast of Point of View. We're speaking to director Bernardo Ruiz, who followed journalists at a Tijuana-based newsweekly Zeta. I asked him what he thinks drives these reporters.
That question really gets to the heart of the film. The film really asks the question, you know, why do these folks keep doing what they do day in and day out? And I don't know that we ever fully answer that question, But we do get into the heads of the journalists. We do get into that process of, should I print this story? Should I run this story? Even though it might put me and my family in danger, it'll put my colleagues in danger. Is this worth making public at this time? And what you see in the film is that time and time again, the journalists have set the desire to publish information that's going to put them in harm's way, because they feel like despite burying their colleagues and despite the violence that's consumed their country, they still feel like they still have a sense of optimism that if we get this information out there, there's the potential, at least, there's the potential for provoking some kind of social change.
And there's still some precaution because their printing is done on the U.S. side. So is that for security purposes?
It was one of the fascinating elements of the story. I was really surprised when I found out that SETA publishes across the border in just south of San Diego in California. They began printing in California because in the early days of SETA, of the newspaper, the government controlled paper sales. So if they liked what you printed, they'd sell you paper. If they didn't like what you printed, they would jack up the prices or make it very difficult for you to get a hold of paper. So to avoid that type of de facto censorship, Blanco Ornelas, the SETA's founder, decided to move his print operations to California. And so there's a great moment in the film where Adela Navarro, the current director of the paper, says, you know, we're distrustful by nature as journalists, and so to this day, we choose to print in California and not here in Mexico.
One of the things people might wonder, as I did, was the title of the paper, Zeta. I mean, it kind of sounds like Los Zetas. Do they explain the title?
They do, and so first of all, Seminario Zeta got there first. They got the name before the cartel. Obviously, they have no relationship to the organized crime group. The name Zeta actually came from the last paper that Blanco Ornelas, the founder, worked for. He had been he and Hector Felix Miranda, who was killed in 88, had worked for a number of different papers together. And the last paper that they worked for was ABC. And when they were beginning the process of starting their new paper, they thought, well, what's a good name for our new paper? And they thought, well, we started at one end of the alphabet with ABC. Let's go to the end of the alphabet. We're tired of having all these papers. So let's go right to the end of the alphabet. So they went from ABC to SETA, and that was the kind of the birth of SETA in April of 1980.
Were you ever fearful for your life in covering this?
I was, you know, very lucky that I always had the option. I'm a dual citizen. I have a Mexican passport and a U.S. passport, and I was born in Mexico and grew up there until I was about six. But I always had the advantage of leaving if things got really difficult. I was in production in the film for a little over 2.5 years. I mean, researching it longer, but between 2.5 and 3 years. And we never received direct threats. But the folks who were the most at risk and who continue to be the most at risk are the journalists of SETA. While I was filming, Adela Navarro, the editor, received threats. After I completed the film in January of 2012, she received threats, not for her participation in the film, but for her continued aggressive coverage of organized crime groups in the Baja area. Now, the situation continues to be a tense one for the journalists at SETA, and I would say that, you know, I and my filmmaking team were lucky to not have not be ever put directly in harm's way.
Do you think there's a message there for American journalists or journalists working on this side of the border?
I definitely think that one of the things that I heard while I was in production from the journalists at SETA and other journalists in Mexico is, you know, we're doing our piece. We're covering the stories of our region. We're telling the stories of organized crime. But what we're not seeing is the U.S. piece. So who's doing the stories about U.S. consumption, about arms trafficking, and about the criminal distribution networks within the United States? You know, one of the things that I've said often, one of the things that the journalists told me was, you know, look, it's not as if these these caravans of methamphetamines and cocaine that are being shipped into the United States, it's not as if they magically vanish when they hit Texas or when they hit California. Obviously, there are criminal distribution networks, lucrative criminal distribution networks, where these drugs are being distributed. So who's doing the crime reporting on the U.S. side Who's doing that reporting? Where are the U.S. and international journalists covering that piece of the story? Who's following the money? Who's telling the story of where these narco dollars are being banked, where this money is being laundered? Who's doing the kind of the wire, but for the Mexican cartels operating in the United States? And so, there are a few international reporters who've been looking into that story. There's potential to do some very serious reporting, but one of the things that the Mexican reporters in my film would tell me is, look, we're not really seeing aggressive coverage on the U.S. side.
What would be the one thing after years of work and production that you hope people take away after seeing El Reportero?
You know, I think one of the most important things for me in making the film is to tell another story about, look at a different kind of slice of the so-called drug war story in Mexico, and to really look at a group of people who've given their lives to doing a very difficult task. It doesn't make them perfect. It doesn't make their newspaper perfect. But do they deserve recognition and international support? I would argue yes. And I hope the film can serve as a platform to highlight the work of the journalists at SETA and the other journalists who work in Mexico in small regional papers and who are under siege and without the kind of the proper international protections that should be in place.
Bernardo Reese's film Reportero airs Monday night at 9 on KLRN. You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. We're online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook, and we invite you to join the conversations and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You may also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Chananga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.